Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking with Linda Molnar-Kelly and Derek Pierce about the design and implementation of healthy and professional teaching environments. Linda is the co-director of the Schools of Opportunity Project, and Derek Pierce is the principal of Casco Bay High School in Portland, Maine. Both are contributors to the new book, Schools of Opportunity, 10 Research-Based Models of Equity in Action. As always, we hope this month's podcast is interesting and useful. So what is the Schools of Opportunity Project and what motivated it?
Well, it's a high school recognition program that has been focused on equity-minded schools who are committed to closing opportunity gaps. And in doing so, giving all students opportunities to succeed. Basically, it was designed to kind of change the narrative about what good schooling is, and which was really in keeping with the dispositions of the founder. So one founder was Kevin Wellner, the director of the National Education Policy Center. And the other founder, and a woman who was instrumental behind the project's inception, was Carol Burris, who is also an NEPC fellow and now the executive director of the Network for Public Education. And Carol had this very interesting history as a principal in New York. And she was noted for her leadership in detracking both her middle school and her high school, starting with mathematics, which is no easy feat. And then opening up IB and honors programs and upper level classes for everyone. And it was amazing. She had amazing results with that. It gained lots of national recognition, and so did she. And she won all sorts of awards in her role as principal. But between the two of them, they and others in NEPC, they started formulating this idea that they wanted to create an alternative way to judging school performance that went well beyond existing recognition programs like U.S. News and World Report that, you know, predictably favor selective schools, often in affluent areas, enrolling students who outside of school already have many, many opportunities. And it's not that those schools aren't good schools. It's just that they wanted to take a look at other things. And so the idea was to replace those outcomes, things like test scores and even graduation rates, and look instead at what excellent schools were actually doing. So what are the activities and actions they're taking to create these learning opportunities for everyone? And how would they figure that out? So, you know, acknowledging that opportunity gaps exist outside of school, such as poverty, but what are the things that within school educators can do to level the playing field a little bit using policies and practices that are within their control? And you'll see this clearly with Casco Bay High School and what the things that Derek Pierce and his staff have done.
What was the selection process like? How did you identify out of the thousands and thousands of high schools around the country, those high schools that were emblematic of the schools of opportunity criteria? And in addition, what kind of criteria were you focused on?
In Derek's case, he was nominated. His school was nominated by another school in Denver that we had recognized the year before. But initially, Carol sent out, you know, APBs basically to schools all over the country, and they did some PR and they invited schools to apply, and schools applied in the first several years to be recognized. And there were many, many, many schools that applied. I was a reviewer at the time. And later, then those schools would recommend others, so that we invited a nomination process as well. And we would contact schools and make invitations for them to apply and share information. And I think in your case, Derek, we actually had a conversation with you first to see you wanted to talk about it. And we kind of went through some things, and after that, you made your decision, right? Yeah. And so that's kind of how it started. And then we started looking at the schools, and this The selection process was reviewers, content reviewers, and experts in certain areas would look at the applications. We created rubrics based on the criteria, which I'll share in a minute. And then reviewers looked at the schools, decided what they were going to write to and speak to, and they submitted things to us. And we reviewed those things. And then if they made a first cut, we made a site visit. And so that's sort of how the selection process went. But the criteria appear in the book, and they appear on our Schools of Opportunity website as well. But basically, there were 10 criteria, and two of those criteria, the first two were required, broadening and enriching learning opportunities, and paying particular attention to disparities in opportunities to learn, such as schools that track classes extensively and don't allow students access into rich, rich instruction classes. And the second, which was building a very strong and healthy school culture with attention to issues of discipline and others, but creating a very positive school culture. Both were required. And then we had others, such as supporting teachers as professionals, which is what we're highlighting with Derek today, providing more and better learning time in and out, in and outside of school, providing students with additional needed supports and services. Often these are mental and physical health services that some communities might not have access to, building on the strengths of language minority students, using multiple measures to assess student learning, and providing rich supportive opportunities for students with special needs, building on the strengths of language minority students, enacting a challenging and supported culturally relevant curriculum. That one was added several years ago. And then sustaining equitable and meaningful parent and community engagement. So there were 10 criteria that schools could choose from. Once they had responded to the first two, they would choose four others. And they were recognized, they would give evidence of things they were doing for all six criteria. And we focused on those. Derek's school actually used the criteria to self-assess. And didn't that determine whether you decided to apply or not, Derek?
Yeah, I mean, I think what excited me about the process is the work of becoming an equitable anti-racist school is forever. It is never ending, and there is always more to do and more to do better. And the nature of teachers are such that they often focus more on how much more there is to do than how far they've come. And I was looking at the time for a way for our educators to be able to focus on both pieces of that, both, you know, what we needed to work on next and to acknowledge, wow, we've done a whole lot already. Because I think to sustain the work and to motivate more work, you need to recognize your successes as much as recognizing what comes next. So the criteria provided a great way for us. And it's also, you know, everybody wants to be an equitable anti-racist school, but what does that really mean? What does that really look like? And you could kind of spend a lot of time defining that and arguing about what that definition is. And the School of Opportunity provided this reasonably wise framework that we could use that gave us a sense in a comprehensive way of what equity in action means. And so that was really useful for us as a staff to reflect on where are we crushing this right now? Where are we not? And then that enabled us to think about where we could focus our submissions. And again, in work that is can be overwhelming and can be demoralizing because you're like, God, we still have so much to do. It's important for people to see, wow, we are really making great progress already, and that both of those things are true. And both of them need to be kind of urgently recognized.
I want to go back to, Linda mentioned that there's a book now. There's a Schools of Opportunity book where folks can read about the experiences of Schools of Opportunity schools, the kind of work that they did, how they did it, their successes and the challenges that they faced. Let me ask you about Casco Bay, Derek, who is held up as an exemplar of a school that created an amazing school culture and a professional working environment for teachers, creating space for them. How did that work come about? Was it motivated by Schools of Opportunity, or was it work that had started years in the past, and that because of Schools of Opportunity, you really started to lean into thinking about how it might feed into some of these other criteria?
So we've been around, this is our 18th year as a school, so we're a relatively young school. And I do think our super positive, interdependent, ever-learning faculty culture has been emblematic of who we are since we opened with just seven teachers, because we opened with one grade and seven teachers. But I think, you know, only in the last 7 or 8 years have we really focused deeply on the equity work. And I think the school opportunity process was really pivotal in helping us to focus and deepen that work, and to consider staff roles and staff relationships in contributing to that. And I think making us, you know, in working on this with Linda, helping us to articulate what is our secret sauce, like why. Does it, you know, what are we doing that's working, and how can we make our secret sauce tastier? You know, what is it that we still need to do? But I do think it's all of this work depends on sustainable faculty learning and excellence. And so that stems from a culture where teachers really care about each other as much as they care about the kids. And are open to the new learning that's necessary to keep closing opportunity gaps.
So you mentioned the secret sauce. So let me ask you about that. What sort of things have you learned about creating a healthy work environment for teachers that you want other schools, school leaders, and teachers to know about?
I was at my dad's funeral, actually, last June, and I was outside a church. And they had a sign outside the church that just said, you matter, or something like that. And I started to think about this concept of you matter and your work matters. At the core of good schooling, at the core of what students need to experience in schools. I mean, it is ultimately very simple, super hard to achieve. And it's equally important that faculty feel the same way, that they feel that they matter and that their work matters, that their work is important and impactful. And so everything we do as a school tries to reinforce those dual notions for both populations of students and faculty, that they matter, that they are important, and we want our students and our staff to bring their full selves to our community. And we want to create situations where they can achieve greatness with kids and with one another, because their work is that important. And so my job as an educational leader is to create the circumstances whereby that greatness can happen with a group of adults working with a group of kids. And so that essence is what drives all the little decisions.
In any initiative or any change in culture or practice, there are always tensions. So what sort of challenges did you face in trying to do this work? I imagine there are always tensions between school leaders and teachers. So how did you, as a leader, try to work with your staff? Because you do, for folks who read the book and read the chapter, you do give your staff a lot of autonomy and agency in the work that they do. You give them a lot of time to collaborate. And I imagine that takes a lot of trust, and the trust that developed over time with some bumps in the road. So what kinds of challenges did you face in doing this work?
Well, I think, as I alluded to earlier, that tension between this work, the work of getting better at equity, of dismantling equities, is urgent. And we need to get better now. But at the same time, we have to recognize that we're in this for the long haul, that we are bringing our best selves to work every day, that we're going to fall short, that we're going to screw up, that we're going to fail. So both that patience and love for yourself as a practitioner and for your colleagues when we fall short, and that sense of don't feel sorry for ourselves. We got to keep moving forward because our kids need us to get better now. So dealing with that tension, I think, is ever challenging. I think it's always tricky for teachers in a community to both keep their focus on the now of what do I need to help this kid in this moment, while also looking at pulling back at what does this kid need over several years, and that you as an individual, it can feel overwhelming. It can feel overwhelming when we consider all of our kids' needs right here, right now. It starts to feel manageable and doable when you realize it's a team of adults who are working together and in the same direction and have a shared vision. And over several years, we can make a massive difference in supporting this kid to be their best selves. But it's not going to happen in the next 10 minutes. It's not going to happen in one conversation. It may be 1,000 conversations and 1,000 actions and interventions. But if you have faith in the folks that you're working with, that we're all, are actively trying to dismantle inequities or actively trying to support kids to be their full selves, then it can feel a little more sustainable. So that, I think, is always a big challenge for teachers to recognize that they really can trust their colleagues. You know, and it's in the chapter, but we talk about, it's kind of beyond collaboration. We try and set up structures where teachers are interdependent on one another. And my success is, connected to your success. So that isn't in a competitive way or in a obligation way. It's like, we are in this together. We are a group of adults working with a group of kids, and we can laugh about the challenges and we can cry about the screw ups, but we are going to figure it out together. How we best move forward. And that is crucial for both kids' success and for teachers' ability to sustain the work and to persist despite the challenges they see every day.
Those are key elements to the kinds of working conditions that are in the research in schools where teachers are actually feeling productive, successful, they stay in the profession. Because one of Derek's teachers, we had three teachers participate in the chapter, and she called their teacher collaborations collaboration on steroids, this interdependence that they have. But how they do it and how it's set up is Derek and the teachers are leaders. They all have leadership opportunities, and those roles rotate. So everyone has a chance to do leadership. And the other thing is, everyone has a chance to talk to their colleagues all week long, every single day, and to Derek. And so they were talking about repeatedly, these three teachers, how hard it is, but how great it is that they have these teams, and they have different teams. They have grade level teams, and then they have teams of content teachers with second language teachers and special education teachers, and then they have their content area teams. And so they work together constantly. They also observe each other's teaching. They even had an equity observation tool that they used with each other to share things that they were doing in the classroom, and then they would talk about it as a group. So there's very little risk to trying new things, to screwing up, because you've always got someone that's got your back. And they talked about that throughout all of the interviews I had with them, and how what a wonderful place it was. And one of the teachers even said, when her mother asked her, "Why aren't you a principal?" She said, "Why would I want to be? I'm a vision person, and I get to have a vision here. And I get to be part of a team that's making decisions." And they make decisions together. And so Derek has been, he's a bit modest, but he has created a lot of structures that work really, really well. And they change depending on what's going on. You know, they're fluid, changing, dynamic, and teachers feel empowered. And they also say there are high expectations, not only of them, but of their kids.
So we're at the point of recommendations now. And I think you've both already outlined a number of things that schools and leaders and teachers can take up and try to implement in their own schools. Is there anything in particular that either of you want listeners to take away from the chapter or from the Schools of Opportunity book? Any lessons learned or particular practices that you either observed or use that you want to convey to listeners?
One thing I would say that struck me, and I've looked at a lot of professional development activities and programs in various places. But one of the things that struck me about Casco Bay was, and Derek's alluded to this several times in the conversation, is these mirroring cultures that the teachers and students have. That the same collaboration that you see among the teachers, you will also, or at Casco Bay, expect to see among the students. But more important was, as they were doing this equity work, they included the students, and they started including the students more and more and more in decision making, including selecting curriculum materials to make their curriculum more racially appropriate, more sensitive to the demographics of their school. And so you see these mirroring cultures at play here, all sharing a vision and a set of values, most of the time at least. And if not, there are many pathways in, right? And that they just seem to be ever present and committed to creating those pathways for everyone, to be part of something bigger than themselves, being their best selves. And when they talk about being the greatness in everyone, you know, you can just see it. I could see it with every person I talked to, with all the things I read about, that sort of notion that you're great and we can all be great together. And that's not a practical recommendation, but it's more of a disposition. And I think that means that it starts with the leadership.
So I'll share four thoughts. One is, one thing that was really helpful, and this happened after our work with Linda and Schools of Opportunity, and when the term anti-racist was on everyone's lips in education, was, you know, we created our vision for what a racist anti-racist equitable school look like. You know, what is that? How would we define that in terms of our curriculum? What does that mean about how our students interact with one another, how we interact with our students, about our instructional practices, our policies, and so forth. So that was a super helpful document to ground our work. And then we use that vision statement to drive our priorities. You know, what do we need? What aspect of this do we most need to work on in our school work plan in the coming year? And what's, you know, what will progress look like? So that was really helpful enough in grounding and making sure that we, you know, keep that at the forefront of the center. We have an annual equity summit that we do where we focus on those, you know, that part of the action plan. There's a particular other piece that's been helpful that we've developed a social justice curriculum. We've kind of named where and what issues do we hit in our 9, 10, 11, 12 curriculum. We're an expeditionary learning school and social justice projects are at the center of our work. But what are the topics we're covering and what's the sequence of it? And we had this incredible example last year, one of my happiest moments in education. We had students take a look at that and point out, hey, you know, you're not really probably doing enough Asian history in the 9-12 curriculum. And when you look at the document, you say, yeah, you're probably right. And so the Asian Student Union put together this presentation for faculty where they presented some places, hey, it could fit into this 9th grade curriculum here. It could fit in the 10th grade curriculum here. And then at the end of it, they raised money and gave faculty, all the humanities faculty and myself, 4 texts to read for summer reading. You know, it was an incredibly generous, loving critique. You know, it wasn't like we're going to, you know, throw eggs at you until you, you know, fix the curriculum. It was like, hey, we're just recognizing here's some places you could do better. And here are some tools to help, you know, it's exactly what we would want to be doing for kids, you know, and to help them fill gaps in their knowledge and understanding. And so we had, you know, book groups with the faculty reading some of these texts, and it's absolutely informed and bettered our curriculum. But without having that vision for a social justice curriculum, without having that vision for an equitable anti-racist school, that work would be less grounded. The other thing is kind of 2 other things that are slightly in a different tenor, but I think super important is you have to make, you know, I think the holy grail in education is rigor with joy, you know, having kids do hard, meaningful things that is also joyful. And the same is true for teachers. Like the work is no doubt rigorous, but you do have to make sure there's space for joy, for teachers to celebrate with each other, to not always be worried about the next thing or the thing they haven't done well enough, but to celebrate what they have done well, to celebrate the relationships that they've cultivated with one another that support them. And so sometimes that means just doing silly stuff. And sometimes it's about meaningful opportunities to express gratitude. We end every year with teachers draw another staff member's name, and then we sit around in a circle, and then there's kind of a gratitude, and someone gives an appreciation for that staff member for a couple minutes of some way that they have been touched or they feel that they have graced the community. And then that person speaks about someone else, and it is the most glorious 90 minutes of all time. And we do similar things with students, but it starts with faculty showing that they can express gratitude for one another and bring joy to one another. And then the last thing I'll mention just as a place to start that's always helpful for me, and it's in the chapter, is this concept of preserve, deepen, and grow. Because I think it can be overwhelming for schools to figure out how to do this work. And you can get so focused on the stuff you're not doing that you forget to do the stuff you're already doing pretty well, even better. So the concept is, in any school improvement plan, you have to think about, what are you going to preserve? Like, what's important in your school culture that's already working, in your curriculum that's already working, that you have to attend to keep great? The idea of deepen is, what are you doing now, but not just well enough? And you need to attend to some resources and support and some learning so people can get better at something they're already trying, just not feeling super competent in. And then the grow is the new stuff that you're going to push your practice that's perhaps a new adventure. And as a leader, it's been important for me to recognize that there's a certain amount in each of those buckets that a school can take on in any one year, right? That some years, like in a pandemic, that's more of a preserve year, right? It's not the time to take on the new initiative. You're just trying to preserve. For us, it was preserving our advisory system, was at the center of who we are and connecting with kids well. And we had to have a very much a preserve year because the grow was stuff out of our control that was already going to take a 50%, how to do online, the remote learning. We had no choice in that. But it's also about recognizing that each individual teacher as an educational leader has their own, you know, mix of preserve, deepen, and grow that they need to do each year. Sometimes teachers need, you know, they're getting stagnant and they're bored, and they need to grow and try a new challenge and take out a new course. Other times it may be at a place in their life where they just want to get better at what they've been trying to do the last couple of years. So it's a part of kind of maintaining faculty wellness and a desire to stay in a place that, as a leader and as a group of leaders that we're attentive to where our school is with those three things of preserve, deepen, and grow, and what's the right formula for the coming year as a collective and individually.
Thank you, Linda and Derek, for being on this month's podcast. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPC Tweets.